analyst note.
And now this Donald Trump election. Those are two things that the market thought it knew what was going to happen, and they got it wrong.
The markets, though, as I said, seem to be liking it so far.
Can you believe that we're actually sitting here talking about a Trump rally after all the predictions it was going to be a disaster?
Donald Trump is pro-business, and he's pro-America.
The policies of tax reduction or reform.
Everybody's in this hope that we're going to get a reflation in the economy.
Jobs have been going overseas for decades. His challenge is, in a not particularly strong economy, to reverse that.
People out of work, people working part-time, people giving up on the job market altogether. Guys with PhDs working in restaurants as waiters. Look, we need a turnaround, and I think that Donald's the type of guy that's going to do it.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, what a week it was. It took the markets by surprise. Instead of a Clinton victory, we got a Trump victory, and that was something the markets and the polls weren't anticipating. In the wee hours of the morning before the election was concluded, Dow futures dropped 800 points, only to rise a couple hundred points and a new all-time record for the Dow going forward. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Coming up on the program in hour one, we will have Christopher Diodato from Lowry's Research. They just published a major paper on the impacts of a presidential election. You'll want to hear what he has to say because there are bullish implications for the market going forward. And then later on in the program, Kurt Wolf will be joining me as we discuss the energy sector. Kurt thinks that in February of this year, oil prices bottomed when we got down to $26 a barrel. He thinks we're going to be in a narrow trading range, but he thinks the bottom is in. We'll be talking about the energy sector. And then John and I will have a brief mention on what moved the markets this week. As you can anticipate, it was the elections. All of that coming up in hour number one.
And I'm John Loeffler. You must admit, the most unusual elections we've experienced in our lifetime. An expected victory turned into a rout and a changeover, an end run around the mainline media by the candidate who actually won. We're going to do a special edition of The Big Picture today. First of all, we'll have Jim Rickards on, The Road to Ruin, the global elite's secret plan for the next financial crisis. And remember that the president is always blamed for whatever happens in the economy, pro or con. But having said we've been through the most unusual elections that we've experienced, what does that all mean? What are the challenges, especially economic ones, that are going to be facing the incoming administration? And of course, how will that affect investments? I think you're going to want to stay tuned for all of this as the Financial Sense News Hour is just getting started today. And Jim Poplava again, Ryan is out this week, but you know, what's really interesting, this was a week that was, as we started out by saying here, it broke expectations. And one of the expectations that we kept hearing prior to the election is that in the event of a Trump victory, the market would simply tank. But in reality, the market dipped slightly and then went up to new record highs. So once again, the pundits got it wrong. It's been an interesting week, and very few people have been talking about the economics of all of this.
Yeah, what was rather interesting is if you were watching the elections at home Tuesday night, and it was at least probably around 7-8 o'clock West Coast time, all of a sudden, one of the anchors was talking about something is happening here because the futures markets were collapsing. And at one point, Dow futures were down 800 points. And so everybody was anticipating with the Trump victory. I don't know about you, John. I stayed up to about 1:30 in the morning. And I think, wasn't it just on this Friday they finally conceded Arizona to Trump? So that was another, 10, 11 electoral votes. But anyway, at 1:30 in the morning, Wednesday morning, watching the futures markets, and the markets were expecting a big collapse. Instead, it was down slightly in the morning, and then it was up a couple hundred points. And by the end of the week, the Dow had one of its best runs that we've seen. I mean, the Dow was up, let's just round this up, 5.4%. It's up a little over 8% for the year. The S&P was up 3.8%. And the big mover were the small cap stocks, because the Russell 2000 gained over 10.5%. 6% in a single week. And so the predictions on where this election was going to go, the predictions in terms of where the market was going to go, you know, I never did understand the gloom and doom predictions. If Trump got in, wait a minute, he's going to lower taxes, he's going to get rid of regulation, he's going to increase infrastructure, he's also going to do fiscal stimulus. Why that would be negative for the market? I never understood that, versus higher taxes, more regulations, why that would have been good for the market. Now, the argument was the market liked something that it was anticipating, which would have been a Hillary Clinton victory, because it's kind of like the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. And so this was sort of the framework that was going into this week. We had a little bit of short covering that started on Monday because there were a lot of people that were shorting the market. And what happened is the FBI came out and said, hey, we didn't find anything in these emails. Then those shorts started to cover on Monday. But maybe the market knew all along it was going to be a Trump victory. And folks, that's exactly what we got. It had one of the best weeks that we've had in the market all week, or all year for that matter. We had, once again, the Dow hitting an all-time record high.
You know, as you mentioned, I could never figure that out. All the time people were saying the markets are going to go crazy, blah, blah, blah. They won't like this. And I thought, well, wait a minute. He's proposing that we create all sorts of jobs, lower regulations, lower taxes, both on individuals and on corporations, rebuild the military, rebuild infrastructure. Oh my, there's all sorts of work to be had there. Why would this be bad for the markets? I couldn't figure out why they kept saying that.
No. And it was kind of like, well, Wall Street wanted Clinton because there were more ties with the Clinton administration, and where Trump would be a little bit less likely to favor Wall Street. Although he talked about getting rid of carried interest. That's a special low tax rate of 15% that hedge fund managers pay on their income. But he is drawing from Wall Street. I mean, he's looking at somebody from Goldman Sachs. It could be a Treasury Secretary. If he does choose someone from Goldman Sachs, that will be the third Goldman Sachs Treasury Secretary that we've had. Robert Rumid was one of the former Goldman Sachs partners. So we've had Goldman Sachs people move into the Treasury. But what was really, I think, stunning, in addition to the victory, and this was something that I always talked about with our technicians, which I disagreed with what the technicians were saying, because anytime you get a new administration and that administration is proposing a different economic philosophy than the one that preceded it, you are going to have people that are going to try to front run or anticipate, in other words, who would benefit from a Trump presidency. Well, if you're going to spend a lot of money, rebuild the military, you're going to rebuild infrastructure, and if, let's say, the Fed is going to raise interest rates, well, what moved this week? The sectors that moved the most, financials had a big run this week. Industrial, especially heavy equipment companies, had a big run. Material companies had a big run. And so everybody is kind of jockeying around in terms of anticipating where that money is going to be spent. And the other thing I think the market is assessing is these plans have been in the works for the last 6 or 7 years. They just haven't been passed because of not complete control of the Senate, and also because the Republicans didn't control the White House. Now you have a Republican president, you have a Republican-controlled Congress, and so it's widely anticipated that within the first 100 days, you're going to see a lot of things get rolled back on regulation. There's three things, as we'll talk about in the big picture: the removal or doing away of Obamacare. Well, that's going to be a little tricky with those that are already on it. And that was a big burden because, you know, Obamacare premiums are going up 25% for individuals next year. And for states like Arizona, the premiums will go up over 100%. So that's a favorable. So there's been less weight on the healthcare stocks because they were beaten up in the last couple of weeks in anticipation of a Clinton presidency. So some of that got reversed. So the strongest sectors of the week were financials, industrials, and materials.
Well, I guess we should ask the question, were there any losers in this whole exciting change?
Well, if there was a loser, it was a backup in Treasury yields. It's hard to believe that if you go back to June of this year after Brexit, 10-year Treasury notes got down to 1.3%, and we had 30-year Treasury bonds getting down to 2.15%. Well, guess what? If there was a big loser this week, it was the bond market. 10-year Treasury yields are now over 2% at 2.15. The 2-year note is approaching nearly 1%. So a lot of this is anticipating that the probability the Fed will be going next month and raising interest rates a quarter of a point. And you have the 30-year Treasury back just a fraction below 3%. So the big losers this week were gold. Gold's back down into the lower 1200 range. It got knocked hard on Friday with the anticipation the Fed will be raising interest rates next month, and treasuries. So the big losers were gold and treasuries. The big winners was the stock market this week.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Pavlova or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Joining us on the show today is Jeremy Schwartz. He is the Director of Research at WisdomTree Asset Management and also the host of Wharton Business Radio's Behind the Markets, which is on Sirius XM 111. It airs every Friday at 1 o'clock if you want to check that out as well. But Jeremy, I want to get your thoughts on the passive versus active investing debate that's been going on for probably a few decades now, going back as the early 70s, I would say. And then also to talk about ETFs and some of the specific strategies that you think investors can use in today's environment that we're facing right now. But before we do that, I just want to ask you kind of your big picture thoughts on global equity markets. Of course, we should point out that after the Trump win, we have now seen a major strong move here in the U.S., and I believe that's true for many global markets as well. What are your thoughts in terms of how the markets have behaved after the Trump win, which was a huge shock to most people, I would say, especially the consensus thinking. So how would you frame the market reaction and just general thoughts on global equity markets?
Oh, very good, Chris. This is a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on the program. It's been a fascinating turn of events this week, and I think the reactions have surprised many people how quickly things turned. You know, when it started looking like Trump was going to start pulling ahead, the market sold off. The future sold off 500-600 points or more on the Dow, and quickly rebounded, you know, the next day, a huge 1,000-point turn, really. And, you know, I think one of the things, I mean, locked to the heart of what's been driving the market over the last few years has been, you know, the historically low interest rate environment we've been in. And you've seen a huge shooting up of interest rates just this week. The 10-year has gone up, you know, from 170 towards 210. I mean, 40 basis points move is really dramatic. And, you know, I think that's actually been a key part of the equity markets, too, in the last few years. When I've done work with Jeremy Siegel of Wharton. I've worked with him for 15 years now, and he has this book, Stocks for the Long Run, that talks about the long-term returns on stocks versus bonds. And when you look at his 200 years of U.S. market data, you know, the real after-inflation stock return has been 6.5% going back this 200 years. The real after-inflation bond return has been 3.5%. So you get this 3% equity premium over the longest period of time. And then you look at the today, and people have been saying, well, the U.S. market looks a bit expensive. It's higher than normal. We've had this 7-year bull market, and can this continue? And you say, yeah, well, the U.S. PE ratios, they're higher than normal. Perhaps we're pricing in a, you know, a little bit below 20 PE ratio, which corresponds to an earnings yield of 5% or more. And we look at that as one of the indications of the equity market's return potential. So what's interesting is if you took the Siegel's long-term 6.5%, you see a 5%, maybe 5 to 6% real return from the current valuations. Compare that to bonds, where the real bond return, even after this Trump interest rate rally, the 10-year inflation adjusted bond is 20 basis points. So, you know, stocks versus bonds, historical equity premium was 3%. Today, it's closer to 5%. So in any asset allocation model, you have to say the premium of stocks over bonds tends to favor stocks today. But if you could say, you know, what's the most expensive? It's been bonds. And now, you know, Trump, big infrastructure spending, more borrowing, lower taxes, deficits potentially, you know, rising. Interest rates are going up on that. You could say perhaps they think there's going to be a stronger economic growth from maybe less regulations and certain factors that Trump's been talking about on the economy side. But certainly interest rates are rising, which I think savers will respect, but it does put pressure on interest rate sensitive stocks. And so certainly, you know, a few factors have been in focus the last few years. Anything with a yield, telecom stocks, utility stocks have been taking the brunt in the last few days of the move in interest rates. So I think that is changing that dynamic. I mean, one of the interesting things, you did frame it in terms of global markets. And if you say, you know, where are some of the best valuations around the world? And we talk about, you know, our 10-year bond here at 210, what I'm looking at today. If I look around the world, you look at Japanese bonds at zero. You look at German bonds close to zero at their 10-year. So even lower interest rates abroad, and their stocks are actually lower priced. So earnings yields 7 to 8%. So you could say their equity premium over bonds is higher than the U.S. And so in some ways, I'd say I tend to favor the international markets, whether it's Europe, Japan. You know, some of the emerging markets tend to sell at much lower prices, and I think then have a better forward-looking return opportunity set. But this Trump victory does start to put pressure on those bond-like sectors right now.
Well, instead of going down, the markets have gone in the opposite direction. There was all kinds of speculation as to what the markets would do or not do given the election outcome. Well, here we are on this Friday with the Dow Jones Industrial Average at an all-time record. Joining me from Lowry's Research is Christopher Diodato. And Chris, I want to go back to election eve night as the evening progressed, and it looked like it was going from Clinton over to Trump. At one point, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought the Dow futures market was down between 700 and 800 points. The following day, when the market closed, we were up several hundred points. So let's get into that in terms of how these election outcomes affect the markets.
Sure. Well, over at Lowry Research, we tend not to focus on the event itself, but rather what was happening before the event and what the overall relationship between supply and demand was before the specific event. So in the case of the election, prior to the actual election date, the market had been down. I believe the Dow was down 9 days in a row, and then we had a nice spurt of buying on November 7th. But still, overall, we had quite a significant decline, a nice correction, especially in small cap stocks. And that drove the markets down to oversold levels. So that already was setting up the broader market to give us some sort of rebound. So when we saw after the election, all that overnight action with the Dow going down nearly 750 points in the futures market and the NASDAQ going limit down for a little bit of time, it essentially told us that we had panic. And when you have panic and you couple that with a generally oversold short-term condition, you're setting yourself up for a rally. And that's the case with any news-related event, whether that be, say, a Federal Reserve announcement or a supply shock or a tragedy or a revolution. Essentially, all news events, they all just eventually, they cause some short-term volatility, but you can still just evade the entire subject of the actual event and move on to your traditional analysis of supply and demand and get a pretty good read on where the market's going to go.
So you guys published a study going back to elections, going back to Harry Truman. Let's go back and talk about some of that and what the market was saying before and after the election. You start out with Harry Truman versus Thomas Dewey. And of course, everybody remembers historically the picture of Truman holding up the paper. Dewey defeats Truman. And of course, that wasn't the case. What were the markets doing prior to the election in the summer and then after Truman got reelected?
Well, prior to that, we had a major bull market top, which formed in June of 1948, and the market began to trend lower. So the Dow lost maybe 10% between June of 1948 and September, when it made a reaction low, and then started to rally going back up into Election Day and then peaked out. And just before Election Day, it started to decline again. But more importantly, anyone can monitor a price trend. Over at Larry Research, we tend to focus on the market forces of supply and demand. And that rally that brought us all the way up until Election Day, if you compared that rally to the rally up to the June 1948 high, you could see that the overall environment, the relationship between supply and demand, had considerably deteriorated. And it was showing you that by Election Day, even though the Dow Jones Industrial Average was very close to its earlier peak in June, that we were still in a longer-term bear market. So the election before, we had that rally, and then afterwards, we had a sharp decline, but it was just some short-term volatility. And then eventually, just a couple weeks after, in fact, the longer-term trends of supply and demand, which in this case, supply was very dominant over demand, they reasserted themselves and carried the market lower all the way until June of 1949. And to measure the supply and demand, we've used the same indicators since 1938 when the company was founded, and we used to measure demand our buying power index, and to measure supply we use our selling pressure index, which those are essentially the cornerstones of all of our analysis.
Let's go forward to the next election, one that was supposed to be very close, and that was the 1960 election between John Kennedy and Richard Nixon, which, of course, we know Kennedy became president. It was interesting because key issues were focused on the economy, which in the time was in a recession, and of course, the Cold War, which was becoming more of a geopolitical point of contention in that day.
Yes, and this election, people might also remember Camelot, because of the Kennedy family. So there was a little bit of a questioning of John Kennedy's character in the election as well. But this was the closest election by popular vote in modern history. So JFK only won the popular vote by 120,000 votes. As far as the Electoral College was concerned, he won pretty handily. But as far as the market was concerned, in 1960, prior to Election Day, like you said, the economy was in recession and the Dow Jones was declining. But before Election Day, and actually just a couple weeks before Election Day, we had what we call here a 90% downside day. And that occurs when 90% of all volume traded on the New York Stock Exchange on any given day is going into stocks which are declining on the day. And also 90% of points gained versus points lost. And that's just how many points are gained versus lost on a stock-by-stock basis are also 90% to the downside, so 90% points lost. We had one of those occur close to the end of October. And bear in mind, this was after a very prolonged decline. So when you get a 90% downside day, that tells you that you have a significant amount of panic, capitulation selling, and shortly after that, we had a 90% upside day, which is the exact opposite of a 90% downside day. So 90% up volume and 90% up points. And that said to us, buyers are back. Supply has been exhausted and the buyers are back. The bottom is in. So by the time Election Day came around, which was only about a week or two later, we already knew that there was an established uptrend, that the bear market was over, and that JFK, he was elected and very fortunate to come into office right before the market climbed almost 20% in the next year. So he's very fortunate to come into the market at that time.
So if we take a look at probably the next one, and also a controversial election, and that was Lyndon Johnson versus Barry Goldwater. Goldwater the campaign against him was, you know, do you really trust this guy? He'd probably press the button and get us into a nuclear war. Before Johnson was able to run for president, he had to defeat his opponent in the primary election, George Wallace, who was adamantly against civil rights movement, which was promoted by the Johnson administration. Let's talk about that election.
Of course, everyone remembers the Daisy commercial where you have the little girl who was picking petals off of a daisy. And then, like you said, the potential of Mr. Goldwater having the potential to launch nuclear missiles. And it was quite an intense election. But in the end, like you said, it seemed like the larger issue was George Wallace, because George Wallace, he was against the civil rights movement, as you said. And after Johnson defeated him, the Democrats were really concerned that the pro-segregation states, which were largely in the South, were going to go Republican, essentially, as a reaction. Even though Barry Goldwater didn't adamantly oppose the civil rights movement, that people were just afraid that those Southern states were going to be given to the Republican Party. But overall, this election, it didn't really impact markets that much. Prior to the election, our buying power index was reflecting a very positive balance between market supply and demand on a longer term basis. And our selling pressure index was reflecting, we'll call it, a very sluggish supply environment. Not many people were interested in selling. And we were essentially in the middle of a bull market. So the election really didn't cause much volatility at all. You had a couple weeks after you made a short term top and then had a very modest correction. And then the market continued higher through May of 1965. And by that point, our buying power and selling pressure indexes had deteriorated to a point to suggest that, hey, the overall market environment is becoming more bearish. But as far as the impact of that election, it was very little, not even any short-term volatility.
Let's move forward to the new millennium, and that was in 2000. And everybody can recall how close that election was. I think Al Gore won the popular vote, and we can all remember the scene in Florida when they were counting chads. What was going on in the market prior to, let's say, Bush's eventual victory?
Well, prior to the market, I think that everybody knows in 2000 is synonymous with the internet and the dot-com bubble. And in 2000, and going all the way up until 2000, what we witnessed here at Lowry Research, looking at stocks on a one-by-one basis, was that the only stocks that were really moving higher were those dot-com stocks and maybe a handful of mega caps. But the vast majority of stocks were in bearish trends. They had already fallen into bear markets. And for that reason, selling pressure was reflecting a lot of selling taking place, and buying power was reflecting that there was only demand going into these very select number of stocks. But overall, the dynamic between the two indexes was showing that the overall environment for the market was quite bearish. So if we go before Election Day, the Dow was kind of moving sideways, and it pulled back right after Election Day, just a short-term pullback. But bear in mind, we didn't actually know the result of this election until, I believe, December 12th. And that was when the federal Supreme Court said, look, they wanted a recount of rejected ballots. And the federal Supreme Court on December 12th said, look, we're not going to count these rejected ballots. And Bush is president. So throughout that entire time, the market just chopped up and down. And then after December 12th, market had a short-term pullback and then had a short-term move higher, but the longer-term picture was negative, and we knew that going back all the way through the beginning of 2000. So it wasn't surprising that once 2001 hit, the overall market continued lower in its bearish trend. And of course, as we all know now, even the dot-com stocks were brought into the bear market, and even those strong mega-cap stocks. But overall, the election, again, had very little significance. And the elections between 2000 and the last election that we covered, which was in 1964, a lot of these were landslide elections. And we witnessed a very similar situation in which elections caused very little volatility outside of maybe a week or 2 weeks. But overall, it was the dominant prevailing forces of supply and demand prior to the election and they just reasserted the longer-term trend as soon as the post-election dust-up was finished.
Yeah, because it was amazing, because if you go back to the year 2000, even though the markets peaked in March of that year, the underlying feeling that was going on is we were in a new economy, the internet, technology, and what was really going on is the economy was heading into a recession in a long extended bear market that really took down NASDAQ stocks down to 70%. So let's move forward, if we can, Chris. I want to go to, let's say, the recent election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Let's talk about where the market was this summer, because we were heading into May. The markets were concerned about Brexit. In fact, we had a two-day sell-off. And instead of sell in May, go away, we had one of the best summer rallies we've had in a while. Tell us what supply and demand factors were going on leading up to the election this week.
The main theme for 2016 has been contracting investor demand, but contracting demand has not really been met with an expansion in market supply. So even though there aren't that many buyers out there, there really isn't that much selling. So the selling pressure index has essentially been trapped in a sideways range, we'll say, since January, and it's just bounced in between its bottom level and its peak level of 277. That was the reading in the index, and it touched that in February, May, and also November. So all of that was telling us market supply really was not expanding. But demand, on the other hand, as represented by the trend in our buying power index, was making new lows, and it continued to make new lows. And even right before the election, you had buying power making new multi-year lows. So it was setting up the stage for potential vulnerability, especially with selling pressure at 277. And we were thinking, if selling pressure broke that 277 mark and continued to move higher, that would represent the trend of generally steady but not expanding supply has ended, and now supply and selling is going to increase, which of course would drive down prices over the longer term. So that's what we've been keeping an eye on. And as far as the buying power goes and the forces of demand are concerned, on the positive side, if we saw buying power, which was at a multi-year low prior to the election, begin to curve up and to start to increase, that would tell us that the longer term bull market trend is still intact.
So, you know, despite the weakening in the economy and earnings, you're still seeing a positive bent towards the market. And usually sometimes as you head into election, there's always uncertainty because the markets don't know who is going to be the winner here and the outcome. Once the election passed, do you usually, as a tendency in elections, see the markets pick up? In other words, the uncertainty which the market dislikes is now removed.
Of course, this one was a major event, and it seems that the market is always going to be waiting for the next thing. And of course, the next thing that is going to be on people's mind, besides Thanksgiving, is going to be the December Federal Reserve meeting, in which people are now focused on, are they going to raise rates? And it sure looks like, by looking at the bond market, that the bond market is expecting some sort of monetary tightening. But overall, what it's going to boil down to is going to be the trends between supply and demand going up until that period. So we urge our subscribers to continue to watch that selling pressure index to see if it breaks above that 277 level, and to continue to watch our buying power index to see if it reverses its downtrend, which started in 2014. And those will give you the clues that will tell you where the market should be heading, at least for the intermediate term. And anybody who wants to look at our selling pressure index and our buying power index and get an idea of our interpretation, more than welcome to always take a trial. You can go on to LowryResearch.com, and I think there's a link that says take a trial, and we'd be glad to show you what we have to offer.
Well, listen, Christopher, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. An interesting study that you did, the impacts of presidential elections. In fact, we're seeing a lot of rotations take place now, so it'd be interesting to see what buying and selling pressure is by sectors as well. Chris, thanks so much for joining us on the program, and your website, if our listeners would like to find out more about your work again.
Yes, it is LowryResearch.com, L-O-W-R-Y, research.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the show is Professor Wade Pfau from American College. And Wade, you did a piece called Rethinking Retirement, Sustainable Withdrawal Rates for New Retirees in 2016. And if we take a look at this, one thing that's real clear, the financial circumstances that are facing retirees differ dramatically from pre-retirees. Everything changes when you retire. And let's begin with that because there's less flexibility to earn income. The markets obviously are going to have a dramatic impact in terms of your style of living. And especially, for example, if you were to begin your retirement with a recession and bear market.
Yeah, retirement income planning really is different from how people usually think about investing with the goal of accumulating wealth. And that's really why retirement income is a distinct field. It's people do become more vulnerable to market volatility for the reasons you're saying, the inability to return to the labor force. And this overwhelmingly important point, if someone retires at the beginning of the recession, there's something called sequence of returns risk. And it's not just what is the average market return you get during your retirement, but what specific order do those returns come?
Well, there's growing speculation that somehow OPEC will start to cut production. And if that happens, it will cut down on the global glut in oil. Will that take place, or is this just simply talk? Joining us on the program is Kurt Wolf. And Kurt, let's begin with that. There seemed to be some kind of agreement with OPEC that producing all out, as they've been doing, isn't working, and all of their budgets are suffering, including Saudi Arabia, which is actually having to tap the debt markets.
Yes, Jim, the crude oil production or crude oil supply is continuing to grow. Demand is a little on the slow side, and there's the difference in between a surplus and a shortage in the oil business is usually very little oil. So we have a surplus of a million barrels a day on a 100 million barrel a day roughly base, so maybe a surplus of 1%. It wouldn't take much of a cutback in production to eliminate that surplus and the firm up pricing. So if there were just one country controlling all the production, the price could be controlled in a fairly narrow range, presumably at a level that's good for producers and consumers. Now, of course, we know how much impact a cut can have, but I don't have much idea whether the producing countries will get together to make that cut. So I think you got to be constructive on oil prices, knowing that it wouldn't take too much to have an impact on it. Now, previously, earlier this year, we've already seen the downside. I don't think we're going back to the downside again, and the bias would probably be to the upside or to trade in this range for a while.
Yeah, because one thing that we did see, Kurt, and that was earlier in the year when we had Canadian oil sands go off the market, taking a million barrels, we saw how quickly the price of oil could move. So, you know, any kind of act of nature or in some case a geopolitical event, you could see oil spiking again. But let's talk about what is a likable trading range for the price of oil, because we do know even though we have cut back in production, as the price of oil got back up to 50, we saw the rig count start to go up. And we also know that there is an awful lot of oil sitting around in storage. So it seems to me that that's going to put a damper on prices. Do you see it that way?
Well, that could well be. The ConocoPhillips had their analyst meeting this morning, which they have maybe once a year, and they proposed a range of oil between $40 and $60 a barrel in terms by the Brent price, the international price. And they showed a chart with most analyst forecasts showing an upward trend from there. Well, my long-term number has been $70 for quite a while. I'm still sticking with it. I'm a little surprised that we haven't gotten closer to it than we have by now. So it's taking a little longer to get to that higher level. Now, so the trading range 40 to 60, that's probably as good a guess as any. In other words, I don't think it's lower than that.
Kurt, what about the cost structure? Because when we started to get into shale oil, I heard figures like $60, $70 a barrel was the break-even point. Then it got down to 50. You hear some companies that are making money, even if it got down into the low 40s or even 30s. When you look at these companies today, what is a break-even point for them to make money?
Take ConocoPhillips as an example again. They did show a chart that suggested that a few years ago that their producing cost was $75 a barrel, full cycle for investments and everything else. And now that's down to about $40 a barrel. Not all of their oil could be developed at $40 a barrel. A good part of it would be $50 a barrel. So I think the answer is that the costs are coming down. There are producers who can handle $40 a barrel for some of their oil, but not all of it.
So if you take a look at overall as the industry, and Kurt, does this depend more on the shale basins themselves? In other words, the Bakken may be more expensive than the Permian?
Yeah, Bakken's more in the marginal area, so a company that's active up there, probably, you don't get too excited about that until you're at $50 a barrel or better. Of course, those numbers might be coming down where efficiencies are improving, but right now, I think at $40 a barrel, the Bakken doesn't look too interesting. At $40 a barrel in the Permian, there are obviously quite a few places where you can make money at $40 a barrel. There's the Delaware Basin up there and near the corner of Texas and New Mexico, where people like EOG Resources are very active, and where Apache announced a huge discovery here back in September. Then we have the Midland Basin, which is on the eastern side of the Permian Basin, where there are lots of wells that are going down that make good money in the $40 a barrel range.
So, Kurt, as you look at the oil industry itself, we just got the recent profit reports for third quarter. Some of these companies, obviously, their earnings are down, so they're still in that earnings recession. In your estimate, as you look at the industry, talking to companies, how long do you expect that earnings recession to last? Is this something that continues into next year? That would be my first question. The second, if this continues into next year, what happens to the balance sheets of some of these companies that are running negative cash flow or, for example, have a large amount of debt on the balance sheet?
Okay, I think we're on the upswing from there. The low point, of course, was earlier this year when the price of oil was lower, and the price of oil was quite a bit better in the third quarter. The price of natural gas was better in the third quarter, not as good as it is now, or not as it's still getting better in the futures market. So what I found after looking at the 24 stocks that I cover, that after getting third quarter results, I made upward revisions in my cash flow estimates for, maybe a half dozen of those companies, upward revisions in my value. No downward revisions. And that, of course, that's because based a lot of my value on cash flow expectations for the next 12 months. And obviously, when futures prices were lower earlier this year, there wasn't much cash flow. And several of the companies didn't make any money. They were operating below cash break even. But now everybody in my coverage anyway, is above cash break even, or even the companies that are highly have a lot of debt, like Whiting and California Resources. They're generating positive cash flow from their operations. Both those companies have cut back their capital spending by a lot. In each case, they do have a huge amount of debt on a balance sheet. It's not getting worse. It's getting better. But if we did go back down to a low level, like $30 a barrel, then these two companies would be in trouble. But I'm not. So my thinking tends to be that, well, we've been there. We're not going back there soon. So these companies are out of the woods and still on the fence and hopefully moving up. So both those stocks are highly leveraged, though, and I call them the equivalent of options, not necessarily a sound new investment because the risks are still too high.
Okay, I want to move on to another political event, which is this week's election. And now we have Donald Trump president-elect. What about the changes to the energy industry? Because obviously, the Obama administration has been somewhat hostile to the energy sector, especially promoting green energy. Keystone Pipeline was never approved. Now that we have a Trump presidency, he is talked about freeing America's energy sector. What are the possibilities and the changes that would come about in, a Trump presidency that could affect the energy industry?
I think there's a broader issue there that the real positive impact we hope from the Trump administration is that we'll have a higher rate of economic growth. and higher growth rate means more demand for oil. So on the demand side, oil looks better. But I would say that this higher rate of growth really is a good thing for the whole economy. And while it's good for oil, it's not necessarily better for oil and gas than for the rest of the economy. We should be positive in both cases. On the demand side, better growth is good for oil. Then we'll probably have fewer regulations. We'll have more fission industry. More areas will be opened up for drilling. More transportation, more pipelines. So the industry can be very efficient. So I think it's going to get more competitive on the supply side. Well, maybe the coal industry comes back to some extent, but the alternative energy industry is probably going down or not going to grow as much. So bringing back coal would take away some demand of natural gas, but reducing alternative energy would boost demand for natural gas. On balance, the pricing outlook is about the same as it is now. Maybe be a little less likely to go way up unless we have a lot of inflation. But it's going to be a very competitive industry, much like the 80s and 90s when successful producers could do well. Other companies did better if they didn't invest because you don't have the lowest cost operations. You don't make money by making new investments. So I think it's a very good outlook for the economy, a decent outlook for oil and gas.
And, you know, one of the things that we're watching is the weather forecast, and they're predicting a colder than normal winter. And obviously, a colder winter would affect natural gas prices. And many of these companies, including companies as large as, let's say, Exxon, have invested heavily into the natural gas area, like, for example, Exxon buying XTO. What are the impacts on earnings of higher gas prices, and who would that affect most? Would it affect the smaller companies or the larger companies?
ConocoPhillips says they're going to sell $8 billion of U.S. natural gas properties. So after they make the sale, if they make the sale before the winter and the winter is cold, their timing will be poor. If they make the sale after the winter, timing might be, and winter is cold. Well, anyway, I think the direct benefit, of course, is on the pure plays. The pure plays tend to be smaller companies. Most of the well-known independent producers have been making their money on oil. So natural gas is a byproduct now for a company like EOG or Encana and Devon, which used to be big gas producers. But that, I think that's what part of the appeal of the business, you know, that at today's oil and gas prices, the companies don't make a lot of money, but it doesn't take very much for oil and gas prices to be quite a bit higher. And even if they don't stay at the high level, if they're at the high level for a while, it makes a huge difference in terms of cash flow and profitability.
Yeah, one of the things that really strikes me about this is a lot of times, let's say your costs are X amount and you have a quarter like we did earlier in the year where oil prices doubled as they did from the first quarter to the second quarter, you know, assuming you haven't hedged your prices, that can make a major difference at the margin for profits for many of these companies, which turns out to be earnings surprise on Wall Street.
I did a lot of analysis in the 60s on refiners, and I came to the conclusion that the typical year for a refiner was mediocre, but the one good year made up for 10 mediocre years. So if you can operate at a reasonable level and efficient level and you're financially strong, then you can be positioned for the times when the rewards are especially good.
So, Kurt, as you look at your universe and you funnel everything from the large international companies like your Exxons, your Royal Dutch, some of your mid-tiered companies, and even your smaller, let's say, exploration companies, what looks good to you in terms of your McDepp ratio? And why don't you explain that McDepp ratio to our clients? Because it's based on oil prices and discounted cash flows. What looks most attractive? What sector at this point?
Well, the McDepp ratio compares the market cap and debt of a stock with what we think is the value of their reserves, their future cash flow. And I assume or project or expect the long-term oil price to say $70 a barrel. So I estimate what the company might be worth at $70 a barrel compared to the current price. And the McDepp ratio tells us which companies may have the most upside on the basis of their cash flow potential that's discounted a little bit by their operating leverage. So my royalty trust, which is a very small group, only $2 billion in market cap, have the lowest McDepp ratio is around 6/10. The independents are, and the small cap independents and the integrated companies are around 8/10. The large independents are around 9/10. And the Canadian stocks are around 8/10. Canadian stocks have been coming back lately. But they take the most popular groups that we hear about the most probably are the large independents. A company like EOG Resources doesn't look that cheap on the McDepp ratio, but we know that they've had the best progress in building there, creating value that we didn't anticipate, because I try not to anticipate too much about what's going on in the future, and they've been doing especially good at creating value. So they're a high-quality stock. If you want to go with quality, EOG resources would still look good. But if you wanted to look at something that's out of favor and has a lot of cash flow potential and a lower stock price and reasonable amount of debt, then Marathon and ConocoPhillips, two long-time names in that group, would look good for large independents. And then, of course, if you're a large investor at all, you'll probably have most of your money in the global integrated stocks. And I think Exxon's going to be competitive with anything in the stock market, and Chevron as well. The European stocks, Royal Dutch Shell and Total, are a little bit cheaper on the McDep ratio than Exxon and Chevron, and they have higher dividend yields. But you wonder if the growth potential of areas outside the U.S. will be as good as it is in the U.S., so maybe the market's making some distinction there. But you can put a lot of money into Exxon, Chevron, Royal Dutch, Total, put a fair amount of money in. I would spread the money around, and not only just in the large cap stocks, but maybe have some of those small caps too, like I'm recommending Continental Resources, which has done well, and Range Resources, which is concentrated on natural gas, has been under a little bit of pressure lately. And then in Canada, we've got a little company called Birchcliff, which is a natural gas producer up there that's made a very advantageous acquisition. It's now a little stronger with more potential and lower debt ratio. Suncor is a workhorse up there in Canada, largest Canadian company in my coverage, low debt ratio, 0.75.
As you look at the industry, Kurt, a lot of these companies have maintained dividends, and there was a big concern when oil prices went from 110, we dropped down all the way down to $26 a barrel this year, that some of these companies weren't going to be able to maintain their dividends. In fact, some of them did cut them. Now we're on the recovery mode, which brings the next question. A lot of these companies have scaled back on personnel. There's been job cuts. They've scaled back on acquisitions. They've scaled back on drilling. They've scaled back on, let's say, hunting for new leases. They've been producing oil during this period of time. Now they have to replace that oil. I'm still amazed, given what has happened to the sector. Many of these companies, yes, they've gone up since the beginning of the year, but I'm surprised we haven't seen more acquisitions, because I would think it would be much cheaper to replace your reserves on Wall Street than it would be in an uncertain market and go out and drill for it.
Yeah, there's been a huge action in mergers and acquisitions outside of oil and gas, but not nearly as much in oil and gas as you might think. So I guess I still have in the back of my mind that company like Chevron might want to purchase some growth in their partner Cimarex, who operate a lot of the properties that Chevron shares a 50% interest. They got a joint venture with Cimarex. Cimarex is a very successful, well-run, independent company. So that seems to be a logical acquisition for Chevron. Now, Cimarex isn't depressed. The stock price is doing well. Selling right at it's a 1.04 McDep ratio. But they're building value, and we estimated their value now will probably go up some more in the future. So I think that's a good possibility. Chevron has the big companies have a hard time keeping up with the, the large companies have pretty much lagged behind on shale oil and shale gas, but they still have a lot of valuable properties, so they're going to make money on shale gas and shale oil as well. And sharing that, combining their opportunities with the successful independents, it makes sense.
Kurt, as you look at this industry and the advent of shale, which took the markets by surprise, nobody would suspect that the U.S. would be one of the biggest producers of oil in the globe in the last 3 or 4 years. If you were looking longer term, and you've seen these cycles come and go, it's kind of like the construction industry and energy. It's a boom and bust period. If you were looking out, let's say, the next year or two, as you do your McDep ratios, what do you think the price of oil, what's your best guess of where we might be a year from now?
Well, my long-term number is $70 a barrel, and by a year from now, we should be able to get there, if not sooner. And that's a steady-state number, and under tight conditions, it could be cyclically higher than that. But all the companies make pretty good money, they make great money at $70 a barrel. And at $70 a barrel, the U.S. production would expand fairly rapidly, and maybe in 5 years or so, we'd be producing as much as we consume. We'd probably be importing some and exporting some, and they'd balance out, but we could be self-sufficient in oil, say, in 5 years.
All right. Well, listen, Kurt, as we close, is there anything on the horizon that would cause you to change your view on the oil sector having bottomed? In other words, let's say a global recession or a U.S. recession that could alter your forecast for oil?
Yeah, I think what would make me change is if things are really good, then I'd want to get out of some of my stocks. But if things were surprisingly bad, I'd probably stay hanging in there.
All right. Well, listen, Kurt, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so, please?
My website is mcdep.com, mcdep spelled M-C-D-E-P, like David Edward Peter. And all my research for the past 15 years or more is publicly accessible.
You must admit it was an historic election this week, the election of President-elect Donald Trump to presidency of the United States. What are the implications of that, especially from an economic standpoint? We'll have a special big picture coming up next. Jim Rickards will be our guest. The road to ruin the global elite's secret plan for the next financial crisis. And then if it is one of the most unusual elections we have experienced, we have to analyze the ramifications of that, the challenges facing Mr. Trump in trying to unite things which would seem to be running in opposite directions. All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.